Hello and welcome to another episode of Brave UX. I'm Brendan Jarvis, Managing Founder of The Space In Between, the home of New Zealand's only specialist evaluative UX research practice and world-class UX lab, enabling brave teams across the globe to de-risk product design and equally brave leaders to shape and scale design culture. You can find out a bit more about that at thespaceinbetween.co.nz. Here on Brave UX, though, it's my job to help you to put the pieces of the product puzzle together. I do that by unpacking the stories, learnings, and expert advice of world-class UX design and product management professionals. My guest today is Mauro Puccini. Mauro is a senior vice president and the first ever chief design officer of PepsiCo, the largest food and beverage company in North America and second largest in the world. This is a business whose brands, like Pepsi Cola, SodaStream, and Doritos, are available in over 200 countries, impacting the lives of hundreds of millions, if not billions, of people. At PepsiCo, Mauro and his team of 300 designers, possibly not dissimilar to the 300 Spartans, have been on a decade-long mission to infuse the corporation with a human-centered culture, spearheading a new approach to innovation that is, by design, guiding the way in which the business's products, platforms, and brands evolve. Before joining PepsiCo in 2012, Mauro invested 10 years at 3M, building out the business's global design function, something he appears to have been quite successful at, as he also became the company's first ever chief design officer, with the CFO of the Wall Street Journal referring to him as the man putting 3M on the design map. Mauro's second book, The Human Side of Innovation, The Power of People and Love with People, is literally just about to be published, available online and in-store from the 1st of November. It is described as a manifesto for a genuine, authentic, and deeply humanistic approach to innovation, one that aims to create personal and social value first. More on that soon. Mauro has accumulated a litany of impressive awards and recognition over the years, too many to mention. However, the one that he is the most proud of receiving is the title of Cavaliere dell'Ordine della Stella d'Italia, an order of knighthood for extraordinary merits in the preservation and promotion of national prestige abroad, bestowed on him in 2019 by the President of Italy. Speaking of presidents, Mauro is the president of the Politecnico of Milan Foundation in the United States, a member of the board of directors of the Design Management Institute, as well as a representative on Design for Good's Member Advisory Council. And now, seeing as I have taken up half of our time together and probably butchered the Italian in this introduction terribly, I had better welcome Mauro to this conversation on Brave UX today and beg for his forgiveness. Mauro, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much for having me. And come on, I'm going to butcher so many English words in this time that we have together. So, you know, just a couple in Italian, I'm perfectly fine. And actually, you are really good.
I actually think, Mauro, that I prefer English with an Italian accent, I have to say.
It's funny because we love the American accent and American love the Italian accent. I think you often love something that is, you know, not that similar to yourself. Or sometimes you hate it. Actually depends. You know, there is people that fear things that are different. And diverse, and there are people that instead are attracted by that diversity and that difference.
Well, let's talk about love. I understand that in your life recently something pretty magical happened, something pretty special. You and Carlotta welcomed baby Beatrice into the world. And now for someone in your position who lives, to your own words, a fairly hectic lifestyle, you know, you're frequently traveling across the world, probably more so now that it's opened up a little bit more. And you've recently said about this, about your passion for what you do prior to Beatrice arriving in this world. I need to do more and more and more. I really need to drive innovation to the next level in my life. So how, if at all, has your thinking about that level of energy you need to put into innovation, your goals, the things that you set out to achieve in your career, how has that changed, if at all, since becoming a father?
Well, it's even more. And just to be clear, it's not about the achievements. The goal says, I need to become, even more famous or have more money, or it's not about those kind of goals. It's more about embodying the kind of values that I think are important in life for any person, for anybody, and therefore I think are important for my daughter as well. I want to double down on those values. And by the way, I've been doubling down on those in the past few years when Beatrice was just a project, but I knew she was going to come sooner or later. My Italian book, she was not born yet. Carlotta was not even pregnant yet, but we knew that sooner or later somebody would have come. So there is a dedication to my family and then to whoever will come in the future. And that was Beatrice. But let's pause for a second about this idea of embodying those values. I think it's so important when you need to somehow inspire people around you. It could be your daughter, your son, your family, or your teams, or anybody somehow connected to you. And you want to build a certain kind of culture in that organization, on your family or with your children. I think the step number one is to live what you preach, is to embody those behaviors, is to be the person you want others to be. For multiple reasons. First of all, because you become a role model, because they see in action what you're talking about. Second, because they understand, whoever they are, again, this is true also in the business world, that what you're talking about is authentic, is real. You really believe in it. You believe in it so much that you live it every day. And especially, you know, if I think about my business world where I pitch the idea of innovation and changing the world for the better. And I talk always about the mindset and the behaviors and the ways of thinking of these great innovators and how they should drive the business, but also they should conduct their own life. Obviously, the more you embody that and the more you storytell that embodiment, meaning that you share what you do with the world. And that's why I'm so active in social media. That's why I write books. That's why I have a podcast. That's why I try to communicate as much as possible what I do. Because I believe that if you embody those behaviors and you talk about it and you share it with the world, then the world will be like, okay, they may love it or hate it, but if they love it, they will follow you. They will join you. They will work with you to make those dreams happen. And that's great. And then with your daughter and with your family, well, if they hate it, we have a problem. But in general, they will understand that you're passionate about what you do. You believe in what you do. And this is what I learned so much from my parents. They embody those behaviors that they wanted me to embrace. They never pressured them on me. They just leave them. And one of these values was the passion for what they were doing. They love what they were doing, and they were doing what they loved. And so that's something that stayed in me from the very beginning. At the beginning, very intuitively, and then later on, I became more and more aware about the value of doing what you love and following your dreams and your passions.
Well, let's talk about your parents. Let's talk about life for you when you were younger and when you were living with them. Now, I understand that although your parents were from the south of Italy, you grew up in the northern part of Italy in Gallarate before moving to Varese. What motivated your family to move from the south to the north?
Job. Imagine, I don't know, for people that are in the United States, for instance, is people from Latin America moving to the United States for literally a better life. And today there is a stream in Italy, for instance, of people coming from Africa. There are migration all around the world, and I don't know the details of all the regions of the world, but I'm sure people can relate. And it's funny because, you know, it's possible that in a time in history, you were that person migrating, and then later on, decades after, you are instead in a stable position and you have people migrating to your region. And it's for me so mind blowing that people forget their history, where they come from, their families, their, you know, all the past of their personal history. And eventually they reject, you know, people migrating to them. They build walls and they push back. And anyway, I'm diverging. You know, back then, my parents moved to the north, and there was a form of racism from the north towards the south. Because of this, the south was poor, and people would move to the north, and the north were feeling somehow superior and, you know, a different kind of, obviously, situation. And so here I am. I was born 3 years after they moved to the north, and so they still had that heavy accent from the south. I would identify them right away as people from the south, and they didn't have many friends, and they still don't. That's the way they live, and so here I am, and growing up with my family talking with this very heavy accent from the south, but I grow up very quickly, you know, in the first few years of my life, surrounded by the culture of the north, going to school in the north, all my friends were from the north. And so I start to grow suspended between these two worlds, the north and the south. And one of the instincts of any human being is part also of the Maslow pyramid, is what defines us, is this need of belonging. We want to belong. This is why, you see, for instance, here in the United States, so many kids coming from different parts of the world, especially those parts that are the victim of racism, of, people in this part of the world, they reject their original culture. They want to belong. They want to be American. They don't want to be identified as different, because we have this instinct of belonging. Other people, though, they have some form of anomaly, a genetic anomaly, and they don't feel that need so strongly. And that was me. I had the need of self-expression, probably to the extreme, but not the need of belonging. And so what happened to me is that I was not from the South, because definitely I was from the North, where every time I was going to the South, people would make fun of my accent. But I was not really completely from the North, because I had these, you know, words that were coming with an accent from the South. And so what happened is that instead of trying to belong to one of the two dimensions, I crafted my own dimension in suspension. This gray area where I was like, that's me. It's gonna be me. And that's my identity. Obviously, I say this today with full awareness. I had no clue that was happening in my mind, in my soul back then. And I realized that this has been somehow a theme of my life. Today, I am suspended between America and Italian. I am an American citizen now and an Italian citizen, obviously, and I'm exotic for the Americans and exotic for the Italians. And I'm special for both. But if I was just Italian living in Italy, it would be different. If I was just American living in America, it would be different. Now, I'm seeing the positive of this. Other people could see the lack of belonging completely to one unique community. And the same, I'm an anomaly in the world of design. You know, I have so many designer friends, especially in my cultural context of Italy. So the designers that design furniture and cars, and they look at me in my position and they don't understand completely what kind of designer I am. And they're starting more recently, and finally, you know, some form of respect is coming from Italy and awards and everything. But for the longest time, they were like, well, what is that? And now finally they're understanding it. And I think the Italian design system is also realizing the huge opportunity if they understand this new dimension of design, of what the designers from that country could do in the world. But in the meantime, for sure, I'm not a business leader. I'm not a marketer. And I've been always an alien in the world. So here I am once again, living suspended between the world of design, the world of marketing. And I am exotic and special, both for the designers and for the marketers, because I bring something to the table of unique. Now, what is the difficult, and now I close, of this gray area, of this suspension? That you are by yourself. You need to, it's like literally exploring a new territory, and you need to define all the rules and the playing field. And you need to be ready not to be accepted by anybody, essentially, because they don't know exactly where to place you. And that means that in a company, they may not have a job for you. You know, there is not a position for you. Now, right now we established design in PepsiCo. There is an entire capability. I did the same in the past in 3M. But it's not been easy. You know, the job description, the titles of these people, the levels, having multiple senior people in the organization, everything is a battle. Everything is trying to explain what these people do because they didn't exist before. Or even the fact that by inserting them in an organization, you're stepping on the toes of so many different functions. You start to do things that other functions were doing in the past, marketing, R&D. And they're like, wait a second, but I was doing that before. Why are you doing that? And you need to find ways to build bridges and connect and working together. So long story short, this gray area, this suspension is beautiful because you can build your unique and different identity, but it's also very challenging because everything is new and everything needs to be built from scratch all the time.
Why do you run to the fire?
That's a very good question. I never really thought about this. I think one of the key reasons is that kind of fire is the fire of my life. It's not, you know, it's the fire that I have in my heart. I don't see that as a dangerous fire. I see that as something that ignites my life. And from the very beginning, I've been always active in doing something all my life. I always had a goal. And somehow that goal in my private life, in my professional life, it gives meaning to my life. I feel a profound joy in the journey towards a goal, even more than achieving the goal itself. You know, when you get to the goal, there is the pride of achieving that goal, but then it's there. And then it goes back in your history, in, you know, the things you did. But it doesn't give me happiness as such. What gives me happiness is the journey to get there. There is a famous Italian poet from the 1800s. His name is Giacomo Leopardi. They wrote a poem that we all study at school in Italy called Il Sabato del Villaggio, the Saturday in the village. And essentially it's a poem when he describes the happiness and the joy of the people during the Saturday preparing the holiday of the Sunday. And the meaning of the poem is there is so much joy in that Saturday and all those hours that you spend in the preparation and connecting with others and talking and chatting and, you know, having fun together. And then when the event arrives, yeah, you enjoy the event. But how many times it happened to us, I mean, to me, for sure, you're there preparing that trip or preparing that event or preparing something. And it's so beautiful, you know, all the preparation. And then you're there, you're like, yeah, this is great. It was even better the way I was imagining it and everything I was doing to get there. And even just the physical journey of getting to a location. I mean, there is so much in that idea of journey. And by the way, one of the points of Leopardi in that poem is that while you are enjoying and you try to be present and you are trying to enjoy the moment, anyway, well, the Monday is arriving. You know, there is already, you know, something else. And it could be negative or positive. It's positive again if you have a new goal, if you have something, a new dream, a new vision, something, a new project. Else, for some, you know, for many people that love to be focused on creating something, if there is nothing after that goal, then you are empty. And that's why I spent my entire life
always trying to achieve specific goals. And every time I achieve a goal, there is a new one that I'm preparing already. Before achieving the goal, I'm preparing the next one for myself. And they drive everybody crazy around me. If I think about PepsiCo, you know, I'm sure many of the designers that were with me from the beginning were like, okay, come on, we reach, you know, that position, we build, you know, that organization. Why all the time new goals and new things to do and new ambitions? And yes, is the fire that is the energy of my life versus the fire that could be perceived by many as a threat in your life.
So taking that notion, you know, this always having something on Monday to look forward to, you know, this not dwelling too much on the success of the moment and always looking to the future for what's next and how to fill your life up with that new energy that comes from that pursuit. I understand that your father and your grandfather are both fine artists, painters, and about them you've said, and I'll quote you now, "As a kid, my house was always filled with their art and experimentation. They pursued their passion no matter what, with a genuine, naive, positive attitude." And what you've just told me there, and what I know of you from the things that I've listened to you speak about and watched, you seem to embody very similar qualities to the ones that you described in your father and your grandfather there. You have a very strong bias towards taking action and doing new and interesting, exciting things. I understand you even physically embody this by having this need to tap your feet all the time. You know, like there's literally energy crackling from you.
How do you know that? Did I write about this in the book?
You talked about this. Yeah. Now this exudes. You know, you exude what it is that you've been describing here physically. Do you attribute this part of who you are to what you observed in your father and your grandfather when you were growing up?
Well, that's another interesting question. I think, and I've been asking this question to myself for years for many reasons. And now you ask me about my daughter. I think children make you ask yourself questions that eventually you are not asking before, or the same questions you now try to answer to those questions with a different kind of goal in mind and sensitivity. And so here I am thinking about education and the connection between culture and education on one side and DNA and genetics on the other. I do think that on one side, there is a little bit of genetic in it. And the reason, again, now this is Mauro talking. I'm sure there are psychologists and human scientists that could give you a much better explanation. But this is a simple observation of reality. Two kids, two brothers or sisters coming from the same family with exactly the same education, maybe 1 year apart, or in some cases, twins. If I think about my wife, she has a twin brother with opposite characters. So there must be something that is genetic somehow. If I think also about the differences between my brother and I, then there is education. And then when I talk about education, there are values that your parents, in this specific case, explicitly try to teach you, and others instead that are just the results of their behaviors. Now, even in that case, genetic, though, play a very important role. Because, and this is, you know, I was having this conversation with some friends that have young kids just a couple of days ago, and I had this conversation multiple times with other friends about taking the role of parents lightly. You know, today we read so many books and there is so much pressure on being a great parent. And the reality is that we have a role that is super important for sure, but we can't anyway condition and design the entire life of these little kids and future adults. We just can't. And the reason why we should take it lightly is this. I am the result, in the positive, of things that my parents were embodying. For instance, the passion for whatever they did. But there are other things that define me today that are the reaction to things that my parents didn't embody at all. They were actually the opposite. As an example, I said it earlier, my parents didn't have many friends. They're not really social people. They don't have friends. And especially my mom, the main friend of my mom was her twin sister. They were in a symbiotic relation. And so I rejected that. I didn't like that at all. And I am really social. I became like literally, you know, I love friends and share my house with people. We have this beach house in the Hamptons that is completely designed to host people. And we have people over every weekend. For my mother, the idea of having people over was a trauma, a tragedy. She couldn't deal with it psychologically. And, you know, it's not extreme. It's really like this. She was really struggling. I mean, I say this also, you know, well, my mother doesn't speak English. So when I'm saying, she's not going to listen to what I'm saying. So I feel free to talk about this. We're planning the baptism of my daughter in Italy. And then there is the wedding of my brother. And the wedding is on a Saturday. The baptism is on a Thursday. And there is the parents of Carlotta, of my partner, are coming to the north of Italy for the baptism. And they will stay also for the wedding. And they will meet my parents for the first time. I was chatting with my brother the other day. And he was telling me, wow, three big events for mom and dad, you know, in the matter of 3 days. And they get super, super, super emotional. And my father, you know, is weak with his heart. And he was worried. It was like, well, let's try to contain the emotions. So these are my parents. They're not used, you know, to meet with people and connect with people and be social and join events. For me, it's the opposite. I mean, it's the joy of my life. So very long answer to your short question. I think partially you are inspired by things you love in your parents, but you're also inspired by things that eventually you don't love. And these things may be just their character and you're just different, but sometimes it may be mistakes. I was talking with another friend and he was telling me, well, I am the resilient person I am today. And this guy is a big celebrity in Italy. He became very successful. He's an actor, he's a writer. And I am like this because my father wouldn't spend any time with me. He wouldn't talk to me. He was always working. He had a bakery. He was making bread, you know, at night and then selling the bread during the day, working all the time. And he was, you know, the old Italy where it was okay for a father and for a man not to really have any relation with a kid and just work. And that was a women thing, you know, back then in their mindset. It's like, you know, this is the opposite of what I'm trying to do with my two sons, this friend was telling me. And yet, I am the person I am, and I would add, he didn't say this, but he's the kind person that he is, and he has that empathy, and he has that resilience because of that. And so, and I close, so many times, now I am here with friends that are successful, they're wealthy, and we're all, you know, we all have kids of the same age, we're having kids right now and everything. And we're all wondering, how can we artificially recreate the condition to stimulate the resilience, to understand that life is not easy, to understand that you need to face roadblocks, that you need to overcome them. I mean, these kids will grow up, you know, in a very comfortable environment, and I want them to have that. You know, I couldn't have it. I was with my brother and my parents sleeping in one room. And if my mom was buying an ice cream for me, she would invite for herself. You know, it was complicated. And so I wanted to give the comfort, but how can I inspire them to, you know, that idea of resilience and the fact that life is not easy and that not to take for granted many things that eventually I will be able to give them. That's, I think, is going to be the biggest challenge I'm going to have as a father.
There's many things that you've mentioned there. There's many directions I could take this. I'm interested in this tension between becoming who you are as a result of the positive influence of your parents and also this active rejection of some of the characteristics that they embodied like your parents' lack of a social life that you have actively rejected, and you've taken on a very active role in being the social glue, what it sounds like, in many of your friends and your family's life. And this notion, as children grow up, they can see and observe and experience the world in the context that the parents provide. There's so many things in that. How has becoming a father, given the pressures and the demands of your role, how has this changed, again, if at all, the value that you attribute to the things in which you spend your time on?
Not much, mostly because I came to the realization of cherishing your private life many years ago. Through a traumatic episode, as often it happens in, you know, in the life of people, when you reach awareness all of a sudden, or before, you know, the time, before events like becoming a father. So to me, the traumatic event was many, many years ago. It was at the beginning of my 3M journey. I was in the middle of that 3M journey, actually. And at a certain point, somehow the company betrayed me. And to be clear, 3M didn't betray me at all. And I still love that company, but certain individuals in that company decided to hurt me. And when somebody decided to hurt you, leveraging certain things that can leverage in a company is not easy then for the company to protect the person. You know, essentially something happened that was like, wow, I gave everything to this company and I love this company to death and I sacrificed my personal life to build so much value to this company. And then this company could let me down from one day to the other, and it's gone. And everything's gone, you know, that I did. And if you center everything around the company, about your job, about what you do, if you identify yourself with that, you're screwed because they wiped away your life. And that's the moment that I realized that in that difficult few weeks, because then everything was solved in a matter of a few weeks. But in those difficult few weeks, who was there? Well, my family, my significant other, my parents, my brother, and my friends. And then something similar happened, you know, later, once again, and that was just the final reinforcement of everything. So back then I realized that it was so important to even be a better designer, a better business leader, a better executive on these companies, to have the right balance, to find time for yourself, to invest in people you love. And why I say it's even better for those companies, because at that point you are a complete person. You don't rely too much on the company. You don't need to succeed in that company to be happy, to realize yourself. And when you don't put your happiness, you know, you don't connect it to the next position you're going to have in the company or to the achievements you're going to have in the company, many magic things happen. First of all, when you struggle in the company, there is a difficult project or something is not working properly with your teams or with your boss, you go home and you have a life, you have friends, you have family, you have interests and hobbies, and you can recharge your batteries, change completely perspective, put whatever is happening in the company in the right perspective. And the day after you go back and you have that energy to tackle the problem and manage a problem in ways that you wouldn't have if that problem was a black hole in your life and it was all your life and you were so focused on that. So, you know, having that kind of balance is important for that. It's important also because, once again, if things don't go as you wish, you have other things to rebalance everything, you know, that is going on in your life. So there are many different reasons that I just mentioned too, of why you need absolutely to find the right balance, because we are here in this world to go after our happiness. Our ultimate goal is to be happy. And work was invented thousands of years ago by people that were thinking, okay, we are a collective of human beings. We have specific needs defined, you know, later on by Maslow as safety, physiological needs, and sense of belonging and connection and transcend and all the needs that transcend yourself. So you have a series of needs as a community, and to help each other, let's organize ourselves inventing the idea of work at the service of our happiness, at the service of ourselves. And then over the years, we forgot the work was at the service of our happiness, and we put ourselves at the service of work. And we are betraying that idea of happiness and what we invented work for. And we are confusing the idea of happiness with the idea of fame, of material success, of profit. And there are two problems with this kind of misunderstanding. The first one is that you focus everything in on the wrong things. And even when you achieve them, you think you're going to be happy. But if you just have those, you're not going to be happy. And we see how many miserable, rich and famous people we have out there. They are not happy at all, because eventually they just have that fame and wealth. The second problem that I have with this is that if that's everything you try to reach in life, well, most of the people that are trying to reach fame and wealth will fail, because it's not that easy to become famous and rich. It's just the fact. And so, you know, if that's what you try to do in life, it's going to be very, very hard for you to be happy. If instead what you want to be in life is create some, you know, be somebody that somehow build value for others, that creates some form of value for others, and all the positive energy you put out will come back to you. If you invest in yourself, in your culture, in your connections with others, in your love, well, that's achievable. It's achievable by everybody. And by the way, the secret is that's what makes you happy. It's not the other thing. Now, the other thing is beautiful. Once you have that, to have also wealth and fame, I'm not against it. And you know, that would be very hypocrite. But absolutely, you need to prioritize first what is important in life, what really makes you happy, and everything else after.
I want to come to your book shortly, but before we do that, I do want to just go a little deeper with you here on what we've been speaking about.
And by the way, everything I just described to you is all in the book. That book is really about, the closing chapter is about how to design happiness and how this, you know, these three steps, self-realization, that is about you, love, that is about you and others around you, and then transcendence is something bigger than you. And so this idea that if you can practice these three dimensions in your work, anyway, by definition, your job and your work cannot be enough to, you know, for transcendence and, you know, for the other two dimensions, transcendence and love with others. You need to find space in your private life to go after those kind of values. And I welcome, therefore, what happened after the tragedy of COVID, this idea of hybrid working and a new balance work and life. That's so great, because we are putting back human beings and happiness at the center of everything versus putting work at the center of everything and having people thinking that work is the channel to reach your happiness. While in reality, once again, it's just one fragment, it's a component, but it cannot be the center of everything. We need to give back time to people simply because we reach a level of productivity through new technologies, globalization, to the new way of producing goods in this world compared to 100 years ago. We have a level of productivity that essentially generates so much additional time that the society should give back to people instead of giving back just to shareholders and investors in form of money, obviously.
So just coming back to when the knives came out at 3M and the reflection that you clearly have done on that situation and how it sounded like it helped to reframe the way in which you were giving yourself to your work so that you weren't giving all of yourself anymore, but not in a negative sense, not in the sense that you were withholding your best efforts, but it almost sounded like you have been more free to take the actions that you've taken since coming to that realization with less perceived risk than you were before? And I'm curious to know whether or not you see that as being true and whether or not being able to reframe the value that's inherent in you as being not entirely wrapped up in the value that you're giving to the corporation, whether or not that's actually fueled in some way the success that you've had since.
Look, I think, first of all, I think corporations understand that the work-life balance is important. It's the reason why, starting from HR, they build, over the years, they've been building all these policies or on a different balanced work-life. They understand that if you don't, you burn out people and you have a series of mental health problems that affect your company at the end of the day and is invisible often. And so it's a cancer from within. So on a very theoretical level, companies get it. You have people in HR, that's their job. And if you are a great HR leader, you study, you read, you go to conferences, and obviously you're right to that conclusion. You must. I mean, the best HR organizations of the world get it, and they talk about this. So on one side, there is that enlightenment of especially the big companies that can afford that kind of thinking. On the other side, though, there is human nature. There is the status quo, and there is the culture of especially, you know, it could be the culture of a company, it could be the culture of a country. I live in the United States. I remember, you know, years ago, I was reading one of the trends in the United States, a research I was reading was calling this trend the no vacation nation, a nation where the idea of taking a vacation time off is seen like, oh my God, it's bad. You know, you're not dedicating yourself to your job. Hard work. We need to work hard. And I remember, again, when I moved to 3M years ago, the entry level employees were 5 days of vacation per year. I mean, these people are people that eventually live away from their families because maybe they live in Minnesota and the families are in New York or in Texas. Those 5 days, what do? You go back to your families, you know, and you meet them. And so you don't have time to invest in yourself, to travel, to change mind, change perspective, discover the world. So all the time that you give back to people is so important. And yet often you are trapped into the overall culture of an organization, a community or a country that stop you from doing the right thing. Unless you emancipate yourself, unless you reach that kind of awareness and you're like, you know what? I'm going to do things differently. And I'm going to be okay with it. But it's not easy. You know, if I think about my journey, I need to double down on the results of what I was delivering to the company so that I could afford to be different and behave in a different way. I expose myself on purpose through social media so many times, showing how much I love life and I enjoy life and I have a life outside of work. At the beginning, when I started to do it, you know, before PepsiCo, when I was still in 3M, it was not easy because people are like, but is it working? And of course I'm working. I'm working like crazy. But I wanted to extract those moments of personal enjoyment to tell the world you need balance. And the more I started to reach certain positions, the more I doubled down on that message, saying to the world that it's okay to find a balance. And by the way, I talk about balance between time that you are physically in an office and time that you are physically outside. But the other thing that I was communicating is that the two dimensions were all also completely blurred in some way. And what I mean is that I was driven anyway by the same values, by the idea of innovating, by, you know, the passion for what I do, by always thinking about generating value for people, no matter if I was in an office doing a project of design for PepsiCo or I was in a personal situation with friends in another kind of context. I would always, you know, extract interesting messages that are always consistent with one another, no matter if the message is coming from a personal experience during a vacation or it's coming from a business meeting. And that's why I started to also consciously blurring a little bit the professional social media platforms with the personal social media platforms. You can find a personal post in LinkedIn or something that starts from my personal life. And somehow then I extract a message that is relevant for the business community as well, obviously, as well as you go in my personal platforms and there are, yeah, I share projects or things that are going on in my professional life. So what I'm saying is there is a perfect blending, a merging of the two worlds in terms of behaviors, mindset, philosophy and purpose. But then I try to build space for both the dimensions and make sure that I am full and complete in my life. And I don't have just one dimension overcoming the other. And as I said earlier, when you do it, then you go back to the business dimension, you can bring so much energy back, so much inspiration, so much learning. And this is very important. And the idea of sharing these true stories, making sure that even the company itself understand what you're doing, that is a strategy, that is part of the value you bring back to the company. Even that has been very important for me during the years, so that what I was doing wouldn't be misunderstood, but would be appreciated for the value that actually was generating back for the company itself.
I feel like the level of challenge that you've been putting to the business community has been increasing as you've got runs on the board and you've had more success in your career. And this book, you know, your book that's about to come out, The Human Side of Innovation, The Power of People and Love with People, seems to, at least to me, to speak really to that. You know, you speak about love, you know, you speak about these concepts that are so innately human, but don't often make their way into the nation's boardrooms. You know, these aren't things that business people comfortable with expressing usually within a corporate context. And you do this quite freely. I mean, this is inherent clearly to who you are and what you're about. But how do business people respond to this? You know, you speak in boardrooms, you speak at conferences, you bring this up in meetings, no doubt. You're talking about it on podcasts and on your social media. You know, do these business people that you run into, do they see this as a piece of art that they're willing to leave on the gallery wall? Or is this something that you're seeing business people become more comfortable with thinking and acting and living in these terms?
I love this question. It's a very smart one. Look, it's been a journey. You need to understand when you can push and when you need to step back. And so you said it in your question already, I can't afford to talk about certain topics today because of the track record of successful projects that I landed in the world, and therefore the business value, the financial value that I was able to build for these companies. If I was entering this company, PepsiCo, 3M before, right away talking about love and kindness, and people would have rolled their eyes, be like, okay, he's a nice guy for sure, but we don't really need this shit. They would have used probably exactly the word. So what I did was, first of all, build proof points as fast as possible. You know, that's really needs to be one of the main goals that you set for yourself. Show value in all possible ways, that is financial value, tangible value. One of the criteria should be how tangible and visible is the value I'm building to the company, prioritizing that, because the more tangible, the more they're going to invest in you and what you're pitching. The more you start to have those proof points, the more you can start to talk about the enablers that drove you to deliver those results. So essentially, if I start to generate a series of projects that are very successful, and I talk about the empathy of my team that was able to enable essentially my team to generate those projects that have been successful, people will be like, okay, I mean, I see that actually the projects are successful. If you talk about this, there may be truth, maybe yes, maybe not. If you talk about this consistently in time, so your story is consistent in time, and you every time connect it to something that is tangible and visible, people will start to believe more and more about, you know, that specific value you're pushing. Then the next step forward, if you start to link that intangible value, we talked about empathy, kindness, optimism, you know, the characteristics of these incredible innovators that I call the unicorns in the book. You link those values to productivity, efficiency, financial return. And essentially, you show that those superpowers are the ones that made those projects happen, that made, you know, that change or the evolution of the culture happen. They generate so much business value for the company, they will be like, wow, I mean, that's interesting. Because, and the reason why they probably are going to believe you is that you've been generating that value. You've been generating value where eventually they thought you were going to fail. So they will understand that somehow there is something different in what you did. But it's not something you come up with after years and all of a sudden you're like, oh, by the way, this was all about love. No, it's really from the very beginning, you start to hint, you know, that idea. You start to share it. But at the beginning needs to be slow. Few things, few fragments of the vision, proof point, and then more fragments, and then more proof points. And then you know, it grows, both things grows together. The more the proof points that are tangible and financial driven, the more you can start to talk about what is really enabling the success story.
You're in a design role where you have a huge amount of influence and the ability to scale the principles and the kind of things that you've been talking about on this podcast, but also on other podcasts in your book. You know, this innovation is an act of love, this notion of bringing these characteristics of the unicorns that you speak of, you know, these designers that can operate with, you know, the empathy that is required to truly understand the people who they're serving. You know, you can do this, and you're encouraging other people to do this. And I just want to touch on something that you've said previously about the challenge of scale. And that is, you've said, we are forced to reconnect with people and create something that is extraordinary for them. And this needs to be driven by love. People inside these companies are really thinking, okay, I care about this individual. I care. So this love, this caring about the person that we're seeking to serve through design, this act of love, how do you do this in a way that scales to millions, if not billions, of people across many cultures? You know, what does this actually look like when it hits the machinery of the corporation?
Yeah, I mean, I love this question for a reason. That the answer is that it's all about people. When you talk about scale, a lot of people think about processes and tools and ways of working, and those are important. If you don't have them, it's impossible to scale up an idea. The problem is that when you have an idea, you have a dream, you have something that works on a small scale, and you exclusively use processes and tools to scale it up, most of the time you kill the soul of that idea. This is very obvious in the business world. For instance, when a big company acquires a startup or a small company, the biggest fear of the company is to kill the culture of the startup, to change, you know, to kill actually the soul and the heart of the startup. And often they end up doing it, even if they're aware of the risk, they end up doing it.
And can't and help so themselves. What is the,
it's just the nature of the machine. That's why in the book, but in my entire life, I celebrate the power of people. Because the only antidote to this is people. You need the processes and tools, but you need to protect in that the soul of people. You need people that, instead of seeing themselves exclusively as cogs in a machine, they see themselves as smart cogs in that machine, because you still need to play a role in the machine. If it would be very naive to say, well, a machine can work without all these cogs, then we wouldn't have any kind of service, any kind of, I mean, the healthcare system would be a disaster. You know, we wouldn't be able to go to a restaurant. We would live in the in the Wild West. We need a cop, but the cop needs to be smart. And he need to be able, for instance, to exchange themselves in the machine and find new ways to connect with each other that are creative and essentially adapt and make the machine faster and more efficient and better through that agility, through that adaptability. And so going back to the question, you need people that understand how to move in the machine, how to move within the processes and tools and ways of working. And therefore, they need to understand the language of the different parts of the organization. They need to be able to navigate it in a great way, in a very effective way. But then they need to protect the intuition, the love, the problem-solving ability, the creativity, the one that when those cogs stop, because the machine is facing a difficulty because the machine is becoming obsolete because there are new machines that are coming to the market, new startups and new companies. So those cogs are able to re-engineer themselves, to rethink themselves, to reconnect in different ways, to overcome any kind of roadblock that you may face in the journey as a machine. And this is what I think is really the big difference between a bureaucratic organization, just process-driven, and an agile, human-centric organization that understands that people are at the center of everything.
How does profit fit into this picture? Is there an inverse relationship between the amount that a company profits from its customers, from these people it seeks to serve and to love, and how much it loves them?
I think for many, many years, profit has been replacing this idea of love, meaning that you had these people in these companies that were thinking, okay, my goal is to grow the business. That's my goal in this company. And I see the product and the creation of value for the people I serve as one of the levers to grow the business. But if I have the right barriers to entry, and if I manage other levers, like pricing, like promotion, like other levers that you have at your disposal as a business leader, I may still grow the business and I can still profit out of a product that eventually is not ideal. But because it's not ideal, eventually, I can extract even more financial value out of it. What is changing today is the competitive landscape, is effectively the fact that you are, as a company, you are under attack by the proliferation of new brands and new products and new organizations that are coming to market with products that are relevant to the people out there. You know, you have thousands or millions of people out there thinking, how can I take your product, your brand down? And what do? Well, they focus on the needs and wants of the people that interact with your products and brands, their frustrations, their dreams, their unmet needs. And as soon as they find one unmet need, one opportunity, that's exactly where they enter. It could be that your product is fun, you know, is great, and your brand is phenomenal, and the service is stellar, but you're not sustainable enough. Well, that's exactly where they enter. Good product, great branding and service, also sustainable. And while in the past they couldn't because there were those barriers to entry, today they can go straight to your end users through the e-commerce platform. They can build their ecosystem of communication through social media. They can bypass essentially those barriers to entry with a product that is better for people. And the summary of all these different products out there start to create not just a market share problem to the existing products, but mostly a mind share and a love share problem. They're making those brands and products obsolete, not relevant anymore, not cool, not meaningful, not something depending on where, you know, they're attacking your product or brand. And so both the big and the small are left with just one option. They need to focus on creating real value for the human beings out there. At 360 degrees, in every single dimension, they need to create extraordinary products. We're living in what I like to define as the age of excellence. Excellence is your best competitive advantage. You cannot protect any form of mediocrity anymore with your barriers to entry. And so this is where, once again, building cultures inside these organizations that put love at the center of everything, meaning love for the people you serve, moving from customer satisfaction to people love. You know, when you try to satisfy somebody, you try to do everything you can to fulfill a specific need. But when you love somebody, it could be your parents, your family, your children, your friends, you try to do more. You try to surprise them. You try to excite them. You try to do something that is magic. It's more than what they may ever expect. And it is holistic. It's in all the dimensions. And this is what should drive our organizations. And we should look at people not as customers or consumers, people to sell something to. We should call them people. Human beings. If you look at people as consumers, you will just think as a culture in your company, that would be the culture of your company, you will think, how can I sell stuff to these people? If you look at them as users, it's already better because at least you look at them as people using the product and therefore you will try to create something that is desirable and is functional. But if you look at people, as human beings, then you're going to be interested in creating value in their life. Beyond the product itself. You'll be thinking, okay, of course, you know, I can touch the life of these people just in one dimension through my product and my brand. But I will try to understand how I can help these people as much as possible through my entry point. And the product is the product and will do something for you. You know, it's a piece of clothing, it's a cell phone, it's a car. Great, you know, I'm going to help you through that. But the brands could go above and beyond the product category. We talk about purpose today for these brands, and every marketer of the world is so focused on the purpose of their brands. And that I think is something wonderful, because essentially what that means is that those brands have such a wonderful platform to reach millions or hundreds of millions, in our case, billions of people every single day, that if you don't use that platform to do good for the society, you're just wasting an unbelievable opportunity. And it's almost irresponsible not to use that platform in a positive way. And thank God, brands are moving in that direction. Why? Because of those barriers to entry are down. Because if you don't do it, other brands are doing it. And in fact, you see the most of the purpose coming from the startups and the small brands. And now the big ones are finally adapting because they understand that even that dimension is important today, and it was not mentioned in the past.
Those brands, those big businesses are now ready to buy that piece of art on the gallery wall, so to speak. Now, Mauro, I'm curious, given the nature of your passion, your clear passion for people, do you feel any tension between this love that you have for your, I won't say consumers, because that's a word that you take issue with, but you know, these people that PepsiCo is serving, you know, these people that buy the product, do you feel any tension between the love you feel for them and the effects that some of those products, if they're overconsumed, are having on some of them?
Look, I think we live in a world where consumerism somehow the norm, right? We grew up in this kind of society and we see that everywhere, in fashion, in food and beverage, in consumer electronics. Why do I need to change my phone every year? Why? I mean, why? Or my car? Why? You know, this idea of access. Rifkin in the late 90s decodified that idea, you know, moving from possession to access. Access, well, is interesting, of course. I access music today. I don't buy music. I access the service of music. I access the idea of having a car through a lease. I access so much, you know, around us. But access means that the moment I stop producing wealth, producing, having an income, I'm screwed because I don't own anything anymore. I access my apartment through a rent. And if I stop having the money to access all those things, I'm left with nothing, not even a house. I'm going to sleep in the streets. So my point is, we live in a society that is all about consumerism. This is how we build this society, not even us, the people before us. Now, it's our choice to try to scream from outside and complain and be like, oh, you know, we should live in a different kind of world. Or if we want to join these companies and organizations that at the end of the day are made by human beings with kids and families and empathy and sensitivity. Because, you know, often people forget about this. You're like, oh, the big corporation. You know, you see just the black hole of the big corporation. And you don't realize that there are human beings in that company that have kids, that have, you know, they care about the future of their families and their environments and their neighborhood. And so what I'm saying is that what I found in a company like PepsiCo is that they're giving me the possibility, the platform, the resources to start evolving this system, change this system from within. And so I call any dreamer out there, any person that wanna change the world, to try to join these companies and try to change with them instead of just challenging them, because that's so easy. Why? And you're challenging, you know, by challenging these companies, you're challenging the world we live in, the entire world. While if you join them and you find leaders that let you push the envelope in the right direction, you know, everything we're doing in sustainability, in health and wellness, personalization to create better value in the life of people, purpose of our brands and everything we're giving back in the world of diversity and so on and so forth. I mean, do this from a platform like the one of PepsiCo with the billions of dollars we have at our disposal, with the billions of people we reach every day, the impact of what we're doing is gigantic. So I take sustainability. I had a much bigger impact than I could have ever had, ever had with any startup out there. Through PepsiCo, through the things we did, for instance, with SodaStream Professional, or just changing, you know, the use of plastic to 100% recycled PET, or eventually avoiding plastic at all in some brands and product categories, and a variety of other initiatives that we are running and driving and pushing, I'm having by far exponentially more impact than any startup I could have ever joined. So are we there yet? Not at all, obviously. The entire society is not there yet. We are destroying our planet. But there are better chances to come in this company and try to move the needle in the right direction from within than to be out there and exclusively complain about everything that's going on in the world or in these companies, just prospecting an ideal world that is so difficult to reach tomorrow morning. So let's move these machines. Let's go towards that ideal world, but let's do it step by step. It's the same thing that happened with the creation of design in the company. If I was arriving and be like, oh yeah, I want 300 designers right away, 15 design centers, and I want design integrated in everything we do in the company. The company would have been like, what? I mean, go back to where you came from. But instead, I started to work within a system that was not ideal for design, and I started to build proof points and incrementally change things. And we are with design where we are today, and there is so much more than we can do. Sustainability, health and wellness, all the other dimensions is the same thing, is a journey. And by the way, is a journey of these companies that need to be embraced by the people out there, what, again, often we call consumers, because they need to embrace the products eventually the companies like these launch to push a different direction. You know, if I launch SodaStream Professional with sustainable, reusable bottles, so totally sustainable, healthy drinks inside. If I push the same approach for Gatorade that you can find in a plastic bottle, but now you have Gatorade GX and you have a reusable bottle and we have pods. You know, if we push certain kind of things out there, we need people to embrace it. We need the media to talk about this. We need the celebration of this effort so they can be amplified. Because at the end of the day, this company produces what people out there want. And if a company stops producing what people out there want, another company will come and we start to produce that thing anyway. So I see not just PepsiCo, but many other companies doing a conscious effort to change the game. We need to reward that effort by buying those products, embracing those products, and trying together to change at a higher speed with a faster pace. But the good news, though, is that I think we are going in the right direction. We'll get there. Simply because if we don't, we're going to destroy our environment, and they won't, and the planet will keep going on anyway without the human beings. You know, they don't. The planet Earth and the universe doesn't need these human beings. If the human beings decide to be a virus to planet Earth will get rid of us. If human beings will decide to be added value to planet Earth and live, you know, in full synergy with other animals and nature, then planet Earth will be super happy of having us, you know, with planet Earth for the rest of, you know, for many, many centuries to come.
Moro, you spoke of the importance of having, you only very briefly touched on this, the importance of having leaders who supported what you were doing. You also very candidly spoke about the importance of having proof points, you know, to actually demonstrate to the business that what you're doing in design has benefit and therefore there's worth in investing further in it so that you can do more with it. You've said, and I'll quote you again now, all of us find closed doors. It's part of the game. If you innovate and make changes, you will encounter resistance. It's natural and you should respect it. So thinking about your journey over the last 20 years in 3M and PepsiCo, how much of what you've been able to achieve has depended on having senior leaders, more senior than you, the CEO, for example, understanding and believing in both you, but also in what it is that you represent, what it is that you've contextualized for them that design can do for the company?
To have sponsors is very, very important. But to expect to enter a company and find a sponsor just because you're brilliant or because what you're pitching is great or is very naive. You can build your own sponsors. You should build your own sponsors. And the way to do it, and first of all, the sponsor needs to be somebody at the top of the company, ideally the CEO, but it doesn't need to be the CEO. In 3M, I didn't arrive all the way directly to the CEO. I had sponsors in different parts of the organization that were not a CEO level. And the other thing to keep in mind is that you should never have just one sponsor. Because the moment the sponsor is gone, you're gone with the sponsor. And you should have a few and then spend your time building so much value to the company that people will want to become your sponsor. We want to push what you're saying in their businesses, in their brands, in everything they're doing. And so how do you build the sponsors? And this is the key question. When you arrive, where do you start? What do you do first? Well, first of all, you need to identify somebody that is powerful enough, has power enough, power meaning resources, to make things happen and to help you pushing the culture you want to push. And then you need to understand what drives these people, not just in their business world. Obviously, if you are the CEO of a company, you are a senior leader, you want to drive the growth of the company, obviously. But you need to understand what drives them beyond that, you know, what drives them as business leader. Maybe you're the CMO of a company right now, the company where you work for, but the goal of this person, because anyway, there is not space to grow in the company, is to move to another company. And you know that this person is going to do a certain things towards that goal. That is natural, it's normal, it can happen. Or maybe you know that, you know, there are other goals that are more personal in your personal life, beyond your work. So when we talk about empathy applied to leadership and culture, empathy means also to understand other people, what drives other people, and ask yourself one key question. This is the question I ask myself all the time, not just with a sponsor. How I can help you succeed? How I can become, therefore, meaningful and relevant to you? At a certain point, eventually indispensable if I really add a lot of value to you. And obviously, what I mean is, how can I leverage design or the culture I want to build to make you successful, not just in your business line, in your business world, but also as an individual in your life, reaching, at the end of the day, also part of your happiness. And so That's what I did all these years. It was identifying people that potentially could be my sponsors and helping them, offering them something, creating value. To do that, you need empathy. You need to deeply understand what they need and what they want. You need to learn their language so that you learn how to make what you do relevant to them. It may be relevant because it's eventually it adds value to them, but eventually because of their culture, they're not able to see what you are bringing to them. And so you need to learn their culture. You need to learn their language. You need to translate what you do in something that is accessible, understandable by them. And so that's what I did. And then when I started to have a few sponsors, I worked all the time to make sure that everything I was building was embedded in the genetic code of the company. It was not just rely on the existence of the sponsor. On the sponsors. I mean, it's pretty renowned in the world, the role that Indra Nooyi has been playing to help us building design in PepsiCo in the company. But if design was just Indra Nooyi toy, today wouldn't exist when Ramon LaGuarta became CEO. And instead, Ramon became CEO and design under Ramon doubled the size. We have the double of the people that we had under Indra, many more design centers, much more integration. But why? Because it was a journey that started with Indra, sponsored by many other people, few at the beginning, and then exponentially more and more and more during the years. And then when Ramon took over, he had his own vision, his own sensibility, his own perspective, doubling down in sustainability, doubling down in innovation, doubling down in a variety of different dimensions. So he push it. And then we started to have even more sponsors, more people that were coming in because of the proof points we were building. So a very organic journey with two streams. One is the top-down stream of the sponsors. At the beginning, a few, and then day by day, year after year, more and more. They push top-down. They protect the new culture. They make sure that people listen, they pay attention, and they help you busting some of the roadblocks. But then there is a bottom-up stream that is super important. And this is the big mistake that many organizations do when they try to build a new culture. There is just the top-down. And then in the belly of the company, in the body of the company, people feel entitled to burn bridges, to go over people that are not embracing what the CEO is saying. And so those kind of individuals and those kind of capabilities, organizations and cultures, they last until the sponsor is there and until the CEO is there. And as soon as the sponsor is gone, they disappear with the sponsor because they didn't build the right roots, the right foundation within the company through empathy, working with others, collaborating, building proof points with the organization and building real, real meaningful value and imprinting the value in the genetic code of the company.
I feel what you've been talking about here is really relevant to something else that you've said. Now, our culture, at least in the West, seems to place more value on those people who are the loudest, the tallest, the proudest, and less value on those people who are not those things. Now, listening is a skill that is so simple, yet it's very difficult, it would appear, to master for many people. And about this, you've said, open your ears and open your mind. Be a sponge. With age and promotions, all risk listening less and less. How many times have I talked more than listened? And in doing so, I lost the opportunity to learn from some amazing people. How do you know whether you should be talking or listening? What does the conversation look like for you now that you've come to that awareness?
Look, you probably understood, this today, just listening to me. How much passion I have for what I say and how much, I start and I talk. And imagine myself in the meeting room or with friends. I'm like this, boom, I start. And I wrote in the book, you just quoted me saying this, is an effort. It's been an effort at the beginning to shut up. And I did it when I realized, maybe the day after or the week after or the year after, I realized that I was in the same room with some amazing people and I was I was just talking and I didn't spend the time listening to them and learning from them. So today, what I do is this. I, first of all, understand that all the time I spend listening to people, let's say there is 1 hour, if I spend 60 minutes listening to people, that's 60 minutes that I'm potentially learning something. If I talk for 30 minutes, I have just 30 minutes of learning. So the first realization is that the more time I spend listening, the more I learn. When I have interesting people in front of me, obviously. But the interesting people don't need to be, you know, the one with a big title or, you know, for instance, I'm fascinated by how much I can learn by children just because of the questions they ask you and the things that they make you think, you know, because of the way their minds work and process things. So that's the first realization. Every minute that I talk is a minute less for me to learn something. Then the second criteria is that obviously you are with a group of people, you are in a room and you are supposed anyway to have a role and play, you know, in that conversation, even just because your point of view, your questions or challenges or perspectives can add value to that conversation and can eventually push people to add even more value to you through their answers. So what I try to do is to really think about how indispensable is what I'm about to say, how meaningful it is in two dimensions. One, for the person I have in front of me. It's a sort of selfless act of love or is, you know, this instinct of mentorship or, you know, sharing ideas that you have, you want the others to know about as well. The second thing is how much what I'm about to say is meaningful to the conversation so that I can get even back through the answers, through the interaction, through the exchange of brilliant minds around the room. So this is somehow the technique I use. And by the way, it's totally intuitive. It's not that I'm thinking every time, okay, let me really buy it. You know, measure the value of what I'm about to say. But I try to, let's say, if there is an effort in all of this that I did over the years and I'm still doing today because it's not my instinct, is to try to shut up more than, you know, talking. I try to contain myself. That's the conscious effort because sometimes my instinct is I'm going to talk. And then I'm like, let's count until 5 at least and let's see, should I really talk or not?
Now, if you're listening to this, people, and I know you will have been, if you're hearing a licking sound going on there, I promise it's not me licking my lips as Moro's been talking. It's actually Moro's dog that's popped up to say hello.
She's there. I have these two dogs, and they stay all the time in front of me, and usually they sleep. But then from time to time, they wake up, and especially Bella, the white dog, for the people eventually looking at us right now, she loves to lick me, you know, it's their way of kissing you and showing affection, but she's like obsessed with this. And so, yes, she was licking my hand close to the mic.
Well, Bella's probably hungry and I know that we've run over. So, Moro, I must bring this down to a close with a final question now for you so you can get on with your day. You've been very generous with your time. Now, you've got one of the biggest design jobs on the planet. I think that's pretty evident. You know, you've got a glamorous lifestyle, a talented wife, a beautiful baby, a house in the Hamptons. And it would be very easy to look at you and think, man, that guy has got his life made. He's got it made. And to a large degree, maybe you do. I mean, you have all of the outward trappings of success and you've certainly got some of the inward reflections that speak to me that you know exactly what you're here to do and you've spent a lot of time thinking about how you do that. And yet I watched something that you said, and I think you started to touch on this earlier on in our conversations, and it was a very personal glimpse behind all of the outward trappings that make you who you are in the public spectacle. And that's, you said, I'll quote you again now, "I thought I was in control of my life, you know, my private personal love life, and then you lose control and you don't expect it, and so it's very painful to manage. But I think it's also been one of the most enlightening experiences of my life and made me a better person." What have you learned that you feel is the most important thing for people who are listening to this episode to remember as they play their own game of life?
Look, first of all, I've been lucky in life for multiple reasons. One reason is that I did things and went in the right direction very often. And so I was doing good at sports. I was doing good at school. I was good at, you know, in the social life. And then I started doing things at work and they started to go in the right direction. This is what I always thought. But then I realized a couple of things. One was that actually a lot of, you know, those things that were going well in my life were in my mind, meaning that I always had this super optimistic vision of everything. But for instance, I opened a company and it failed. You know, my agency failed. I had to close my agency. That was not good. And yet, I realized this just a few weeks ago, not even like years ago, weeks ago. I was talking about that. And for the first time in my life, I was like, wait a second. I remember that as an amazing success, but if I failed. But why? Because I'm such an optimistic person that I saw what that agency gave me, a wonderful experience with an amazing person that was my partner. And I learned so much. And then I use all the learning at 3M. So first of all, the first message is be positive and enjoy the moment. I was always happy. I was happy also when I had one room and the four of us, me, my parents, and my brother, were sleeping in the room where when we couldn't afford an ice cream, I was happy. I didn't desire to be richer or famous, you know, in the future. No. As I said earlier, always the journey was something that I love. Always the potential, you know, what you could do and what you could do in life. And so for many, many years, I lived life thinking of having these superpowers because I was thinking that everything was going well in my life. Now, it did go well, just to be clear. You know, else I wouldn't be where I am. But there have been many difficulties and roadblocks and situations that were, you know, very challenging in my childhood and then later on. And so, first, optimistic vision of the world. But then something else happened. In between 2015 and 2016, I went through a very painful divorce. And I, as you mentioned earlier, I lost control of my life, meaning that until then, I was thinking that I was always in control. One of the things, and there were two components of this control. One was the actual control, meaning that I was doing things and things more or less were going well. But the other control was the control of my mind. I was a positive thinker. And I, as I said earlier, would see things, even if they were not going in the right direction, I would always look at the positive side. But that painful divorce and everything that happened in connection to that divorce impacted also my positivity. And so I felt in the spiral, in a loop that brought me to depression. And this is something that I never experienced in my life. I never thought that it could even be possible for somebody like me to be depressed because I'm the opposite and I've been always pretty stable. So I didn't think it was possible. So I realized that I was not invincible, that I realized that there is a pain out there that I thought didn't really exist. I never saw mental issues and depression as something that was an actual disease. I always thought, well, come on, I mean, you're depressed. Be more positive, you know, and, except obviously if you have a serious, you know, problem and, you know, that. But in general, the reality is there are so many people that have mental issues that are invisible to others. So I realized that amplified to the extreme my empathy and my sensitivity in everything I do, making me a much better person. And then it built so much awareness about the value of kindness, of love. That moment in my life made me look back at, you know, the person I was before that had kindness and love and empathy within himself. But he built a new layer of awareness that I never had until that point about the superpower of kindness or love and all these dimensions. So that after the crisis, I invested so much more in those dimensions and I started to become an ambassador of those values out there. Also because the kind people around me, both at work and outside, my friends, are the ones that literally save me. And when I say save me, I mean save me. Because you're right to a point where, like, even if everything is perfect, you're like, you almost don't want to live anymore, right? But I never arrived to the extreme thought of taking my life because I was surrounded by a support system that was incredible, of beautiful people, nice people, kind people. And that was really like life-saving. And so after that, I was like, wow, I'm going to transform my life in this mission of spreading this idea. And spreading, and when I realized that, obviously it all started from a personal realization in my personal life, you know, the power of friendship and love to help people in your personal life. But then I was like, okay, but I have a platform in the business world as well. And I have hundreds of people, you know, in my organization. And so that's when I started to look back with more consciousness and awareness about the traits of these people, the kind of people that I hire. And then I realized that actually I was hiring anyway kind people and people with this kind of characteristics just because that was my background, thanks to my parents. But then I became aware about those superpowers and I started to really celebrate them and pitch them and drive them. And then, you know, in the past 6-7 years, you hear me talking about this in every podcast, in every article, in every interview, in my book, is the title of my book. And so that's what I meant, you know, that moment changed my life and made me a better person. And it's probably the most difficult moment of my life because maybe, you know, I had other difficult moments, but for what happened to me, meaning that I reached the bottom mentally. And I think it's a beautiful lesson, this idea that in the most difficult moment of your life, when you think that, wow, you know, where do I go? That's where you learn the most. That's where you better yourself the most. That's where you grow the most. And so now, even when I face, you know, other moments that are, you know, small difficulties of your everyday life, I always remind myself also this, that in the difficulties is when you stand up, you grow, you become a better person. And so they're all part of the journey that is called life.
What a beautiful note to end on. It all makes sense now, Mauro. Thank you for being so open and honest and for sharing some very powerful and informative messages for the people that are listening to our conversation today.
Thank you so much for having me today. Thanks for everybody listening to us. And good luck to everybody in your journey, in your life journey, your professional journey. And be kind, spread this idea of love that is useful for the business, but mostly useful for yourself, for ourselves, and for our society.
Mauro, if people want to pick up a copy of The Human Side of Innovation, or if they want to follow you in some way to connect with you, what's the best way for them to do that?
Well, you can find it in all the places that sell books, but an easy one is Amazon. Usually that's a very easy one. And I'm very active both in my LinkedIn, Mauro Porcini, and in my Instagram, Mauro Porcini as well. I post every day and you can reach me there and we can have conversations there if you like.
Perfect. Thanks, Mauro. And to everyone that's tuned in, it's been great having you here as well. Everything we've covered will be in the show notes, complete chapters on YouTube, so you can hop around and get to the bits of the conversation that you want to hear again. You can also find Mauro in the show notes. There'll be links to his new book that's coming out and to all of his social media, as he's mentioned. So please check those out. If you've enjoyed the show and you want to hear more great conversations like this with world-class leaders in UX, design, and product management, don't forget to leave a review, subscribe to the podcast as well so it turns up every week, and Pass the podcast along, pass the conversation that you've just heard along to someone who you feel would get value from what we've just discussed. If you want to reach out to me, you can find me on LinkedIn. Just search for Brendan Jarvis, or you can find a link to my profile at the bottom of the show notes as well. Or head on over to thespaceinbetween.co.nz. That's thespaceinbetween.co.nz. And until next time, keep being brave.